Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What knowledge of local culture and traditions is necessary to design a building that belongs in the place where it's erected and truly works for the people who will use it? Architect Stephen Ehrlich began his professional life serving as the first Peace Corps architect in Marrakesh, Morocco, an experience that allowed him to contribute to sound infrastructure in North Africa, but also to learn from the innovations of indigenous builders. Ehrlich later traveled across the Sahara and taught for several years at a university in Nigeria before returning to the U.S. and ultimately founding the firm Stephen Ehrlich Architects, where he continues to work as design principal. His designs have won dozens of awards, and this year, Ehrlich joined Tom Main, Frank Gehry, and others as a recipient of the Maybeck Prize for Lifetime Achievement in Architecture. Stephen Ehrlich is in town to serve as lead juror for the 2011 AIA Dallas Design Awards. I'm delighted that he could make time for us today. Stephen, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's nice to be here.
You have called yourself an architectural anthropologist. Can you talk about what that means?
Sure. I use that term based on the fact that I did spend a long time in my early career in Africa, both Morocco and Nigeria and other parts of West Africa. And those 6 years were very formative in my life. It was a time when I was really absorbing information and seeing how other cultures live and also seeing how the architecture responded so delicately and with such wisdom according to the climate and the culture. And all of that kind of made a great impression on me.
Did you join the Peace Corps thinking this will really set the tone for the rest of my career, or did you think I'll use my skills for a good purpose for a couple of years and then get on to real architecture?
I wasn't really sure what I was getting into. Mm-hmm. It was a wild time back in the late 60s. The Peace Corps was a great opportunity. They had just started an architecture program in Morocco. So I was the first architect placed by the Peace Corps to work for the Moroccan government of urban planning and architecture. And no, I didn't know what I was going to get, but I got a lot. I found out that people live differently than we do in America. It broadened my mind. I learned about courtyard houses, eating with your hands, the warmth of other cultures, and also the sustainable wisdom of indigenous builders.
Talk about your relationship with indigenous builders there. I mean, it has to be both humbling and empowering to work with people who have not had traditional formal training but have created structures that have served them really well for a long time.
Yeah, that's true. An indigenous builder is always working with the materials that are found locally. It's not like they're going to be importing glass from Italy. Right. And they're using, obviously, labor, their own personal skills, because that's what they've been doing for centuries. And it responds very, very directly and harmoniously to the environment. So there is a lot to learn from them.
When you talk about something like courtyard housing, that's really interesting because it sounds like in a traditional culture, the housing is built that way because that's how people like to live, as opposed to building something and hoping that you can inspire people to live in a particular way.
Well, courtyard houses are interesting. In Marrakesh, which is a very hot climate, probably similar to Dallas's climate, it gets well into the hundreds in the hot period of time in the year, during the year. And the courtyard house is an amazing concept because what you have is thick walls. The houses are typically two stories tall, and all of the rooms open up into an outdoor courtyard. So when it's hot outside during the day, you go into the cool room, and when the thick mud walls or brick walls heat up, and you then, from there, you go into the courtyard at night where it's cool because the night cools off a bit, certainly more than the daytime. Mm-hmm. And so you're living in a kind of very harmonious way. And they don't have the muscle to apply and have air conditioning. They're doing it in a very delicate balance with their own environment.
When you were teaching in Nigeria, did you find that the students came to the work with an entirely different set of skills and assumptions than your American classmates had?
very different. And there was actually something quite ironic. When I was teaching at Amadou Bello University in Zaria, Nigeria, which is in the north, now this would have been in the mid-70s, from 74 to 77. And the many of the professors were actually from Eastern Europe, and they were, and the campus, by the way, which is a large steel and glass and concrete campus, was designed by Europeans generally. And it was done in such a way that they were not really listening to the people or the place. And so I actually became a proponent as a teacher there to have the students look to their own history, look to the wisdom of their local builders, if you will, and don't attempt to repeat it. Of course, don't build necessarily out of thatched roofs and mud walls. Embrace modern technology. Embrace all the amenities that, you know, are available at that moment in time. But to understand what had come before them, and to learn from that wisdom. And the students were very excited to do that. They embraced it.
Did it feel to you like a sort of a vestige of colonialism that for a while, at least in those places, it was assumed that you needed an architect from Europe or from the U.S. to give you a good building?
I think that existed. And ironically, I think it exists in many parts of the world today, only in a different way. I think that there are many places in the world that are really looking to buy a brand name versus mm-hmm. necessarily a building made specifically or eloquently for that place or that time.
What about the West? Do you feel like we are in danger of having our built spaces be completely detached from the land on which they sit and the people that they serve?
No, I don't think so. I think that there's actually a strong movement. If I look at some of the architecture going on here in the U.S. and in the West, I mean, I think that there are really fabulous architects doing beautiful work that is rooted to the land. And there's a term that a scholar named Kenneth Frampton employed, which is critical regionalism, which means that projects are specifically rooted to their place, and yet they are contemporary and aspirational to sort of new issues.
I was looking online at some of your designs, and at this point I'm speaking about houses, and you have a lot of spaces that sort of flow from indoors to outdoors, which of course we can't do in every part of the United States, but it made me really want glass walls.
Well, one of the things that we do like to do, and we are blessed in Southern California with a great climate, but mind you, we do houses not only in Southern California, and we do houses in Southern California in desert environments as well. So we employ a lot of glass, it's true. And actually, what I like to do with glass is I like to see it disappear. That's the exciting part, when a glass wall can slide completely away or roll up, and so that suddenly there is no barrier, there is no glass in the way. You just have a pure fusion of indoor and outdoor space. And it's something I've been perfecting for literally the last three decades.
When you say perfecting, I mean, there's engineering involved to get that right, obviously.
There is, and there are some fabulous manufacturers out there that help do it. But sometimes you can take it even a step further if you are willing to take a risk or two. In our own house in Venice, California, I have a 16-foot aperture, 16-foot high, 16-foot wide, and with two panels of 16-foot glass, the glass can slide completely out of the way into a pocket in the wall, and the threshold is merely an eighth-inch high mm-hmm. little piece of stainless steel coming out of the concrete floor that it just slides on. So that was all very experimental, and I can do that on my own house. I won't do that with clients until at least proven to work twice before.
Forgive me for asking what seems like a very pedestrian question, but as a parent, I know that your kids are grown, but you do have grandkids. Do you worry at all with materials like that? You know, what would it cost to fix a 16-by-16-foot piece of glass?
Well, no, I have total confidence in the glass. I mean, it's tempered glass. It all works. That's not the issue. And it's engineered, so I'm not worried about that part of it. It was really the mechanism that was sort of a new invention. However, you bring up an interesting point. My wife and I have lived in this particular house in Venice for 8 years now, and I have a bridge that floats across a space with no – well, I do have one bar, but essentially no handrail – no hand-railing barricade, if you will. And it wasn't that long ago. And also, I might add that the stairway going up to it was very adventurous and very sculptural. You know, us architects like to push the limits a bit. And anyway, my 2.5-year-old grandson was looking down at us one day. We didn't even know he went up there, down from the bridge. And finally, the light bulb went on, and we're fixing it.
I'm sure it's the most fabulous place in the world for him, though.
Well, it's a great place to be, but it has to be safe, yes.
What is the dialogue between sculpture and what's taking place right now in the fine art world and the world of architecture?
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, I think a lot of – not a lot. I think some architects are actually practicing the largest – are creating the largest sculptures. Mm-hmm. I think Frank Gehry is an amazing architect and who, in fact, is making the largest sculptures in the world. I'm teaching right now. I'm a visiting professor at USC, and I made it real clear to them that I'm teaching architecture, not sculpture, and mm-hmm. that architecture has to respond to all of the fundamentals of how do people come together, what is the urban fabric, space, light, mass, form, etc. So there is a difference, and I still fundamentally believe that architecture is for people.
Do you always imagine the outside form of a building before you think about what will be inside?
No, I'd say that the design evolves from a kind of an integration of all the forces shaping it, and it goes back and forth. And interestingly enough, many years ago, as a single sole practitioner 30 years ago, I mean, it all came from my hand and onto the sketchbook. And now buildings are much more complex. There needs to be a much greater understanding of the program, perhaps historical precedent, a myriad of issues. And now there's quite a bit of collaboration within our office of about almost 30 people. And it's really exciting to work with talented people, often younger people, and create teams that resolve the issues.
Do you see yourself even in your own office as a sort of mentor to those younger people that you take on as associates?
I do. And I'm willing to be challenged and learn. And to me, the best idea should be the idea that actually gets done. It doesn't matter who comes up with it.
It's got to take them a while, I imagine, to feel confident enough to say, actually, I think we should do it this way, to you.
No, we create an atmosphere where they feel comfortable to say that. And often we'll, you know, because again, we're not just resolving aesthetic issues. We're resolving complex, programmatic requirements. Let me give you one example. Mm-hmm. We finished not too long ago the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism mm-hmm. and Mass Communication for Arizona State University in downtown Phoenix on their downtown campus. And there was a myriad of design programs that had to be integrated, one of them including TV and radio studios. Mm-hmm. So it really took a lot of teamwork.
We'll talk more about that in just a moment. My guest this hour is architect Stephen Ehrlich. He's the winner of the 2011 Maybeck Award for Lifetime Achievement in Architecture and lead juror for the 2011 AIA Dallas Design Awards. If you'd like to join our conversation, the phone lines are open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is architect Stephen Ehrlich. He is in town to serve as lead juror for the 2011 AIA Dallas Design Awards. You can learn more about that at aiadallas.org. If you'd like to join our conversation, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So before the break, Stephen, you started to tell us about the Cronkite building at the University, Arizona State University, excuse me. And this is the one that you had a very short amount of time from the design process through the time that people were moving in and working there.
Yes. Let me give you a sense of the scale of the building. Mm-hmm. It's 230,000 square feet. It is in the downtown campus, right along the new light rail, actually, which is very exciting. Location. And it's six stories tall, and it's a post-tension concrete structure. It has very technical TV and radio TV studios, radio station, all kinds of teaching facilities for journalism and mass communication. And we were able to deliver that project with our teammates through a methodology called design build, where the contractor and the architect create a team. And that team works together towards the common goal of building this building often very quickly. And we were, from the beginning, from the moment that we began the design process to occupancy took 22 months, which is unheard of. And we had teamed up with Sunt Construction, and our local executive architect was HDR.
How do you do you have to have the entire design complete before the construction begins in something like this, or are you making amendments along the way?
That's a good question. There is something called fast track, and we did embrace fast track in this case, which means that you have to have the fundamentals of the building designed. You have to have the structural system completely engineered. It has to have been calculated and approved by the city. So then construction begins with the structural frame, the foundations, et cetera. And at the same time, we're still working out interior finishes and details and technology elements within.
I would imagine that everyone in your position finds it very important to communicate well with clients. But do you have a specific set of questions that you like to ask them to feel like you really understand who they are and what they need?
That always has to happen, and the questions are not set. It has to be, first of all, what do they come to us with? Sometimes they come to us with actually just wanting to sit around the table and talk, and sometimes they come with 100 pages of a document called a program. I think it's always important to fundamentally ask, what does this building really want to be, and to understand the essence of it. And that does take just good old fashion conversation. It's a good way to go. But as buildings become more complicated, they do need to they need to communicate those specifics to us. I'm just thinking out loud right now that we're doing a second building now for Arizona State University, which is the School of Earth and Space Exploration.
And you get all the cool buildings.
Well, that one is a pretty cool one. We're happy about it. The head scientist is a man named Kip Hodges, who actually, with conversations with him, a lot of the design of the building evolved with kind of his vision and goals of how he wanted people to come together and collaborate and bump into each other, if you will.
In the public spaces, you mean?
In the semi-public spaces, that is correct. And in the public spaces, mm-hmm. Yes.
How do you think about that? Do clients always know what sort of interaction will take place or is likely to take place or should take place in those public and semi-public spaces?
There definitely is an understanding today that synergy is very important, and people, and this is a personal belief of mine as well, that people are becoming more isolated as time goes on based on technology. We're all getting deeper into our computer screens, our iPhones, our experiments, whatever those may be. And that sometimes it's just bumping into your fellow scientist or your fellow journalist or your fellow co-voyager in whatever field you're in, and having a conversation. So we're now trying to connect people not only horizontally but vertically. And for example, in the new School of Space and Earth Exploration, we have a 5-story skylit atrium where we create larger extended platforms that I like to call living rooms in the sky. Mm-hmm. And that allows people to sit down on comfortable chairs. They're usually located very close to the coffee bar. And people do bump into each other. And on the main floor of the atrium, there's a series of very comfortable chairs where they sit on a custom-made carpet of craters. We've taken photographs of craters from different planets.
It does seem that there are many buildings where you have the opportunity to bump into someone, but then not to retreat to what feels like a somewhat more private space to have that conversation.
Well, it is also important that they can go back to their to have some sense of privacy for their experiments. But we let them hopefully define the specific work environment that they need for their laboratories and or offices.
Let's go to the phones now. We have a full board of calls at 1-800-933-5372. Remember, you can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go first on the line to Randall in Dallas. Hi, Randall.
Hello. I'm just privileged to be on the show today.
Welcome.
I've thought often, I've done some traveling and been to London and the London Eye, and I come back and I think, Dallas doesn't have an iconic symbol. And it's your comments on the community spaces and connecting and what connects makes me think that the Trinity River, even though we have our Trinity River project, is still one of the most underused features of our city. And I kind of have this interesting vision of a shopping mall that arches across the Trinity to connect Oak Cliff in downtown Dallas.
Well, before, Randall, we get a response from Stephen, I will let you know that he just got in town this morning, so he may not be fully familiar with all the places you're talking about, but maybe you can speak to that in a general sense.
Well, I don't know Dallas well enough to truly comment on your proposal or concept. I will just say that I think cities need town squares, if you will, and if there could be a place where people know that this is the heart of our city and this is where, we could go to feel connected, that would be a great thing. I don't know if I'd make it a shopping mall. To me, it would probably have a more civic public aspect to it. I have been I have been a visitor to the Arts District in the past, and that does seem to be starting that kind of public space.
When you are designing a building that will go into an already densely populated urban space, how much thought do you give to how your design might influence someone who comes along a decade from now and makes another building nearby?
Well, I think that architecture has a responsibility to be timeless. I think it's not necessarily of the moment, and buildings a solid civic building, public building, should be built to last 100 years, perhaps more. Of course, if it's maintained, it will. So in terms of what is built next door, let it be also a sign of its times and a response to the conditions at hand.
We've been talking about modern architecture for the better part of a century now. Can you talk a little bit about how that idea has evolved, even in the 40 or so years of your career?
Well, modern architecture is a wonderful phenomenon because we have, it's interesting, technology has changed a lot in 40 years, but it's been mostly in electronics and in some materials and research. So we have much better materials such as glass. We have better structural systems. Steel can do many more things than it did even 40 years ago. So that creates new freedoms, which is great. But I think in the end, it's still, what is the mission? What is the mission statement? And I think that now I see that people, cities, institutions are really embracing sustainability as a very important issue, and which I'm smiling right now because it goes right back to my experiences in Africa, mm-hmm. where I mean, they are the most sustainable builders in the world.
Out of necessity.
Out of necessity. Very simple. But coming fast forward to where we are in the United States, I think that it's a very important mission, and the technologies are there and improving all the time, which is great. But there's also the fundamentals. I mean, don't build a glass wrapped skyscraper in Dallas, Texas. It just, where every facade is reflective glass, it just makes no sense.
Have contractors come along towards sustainability at the same rate that architects have?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that, but certainly sophisticated contractors are well aware of it and want to embrace it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to, excuse me, I'm trying to press my line, Romy in Dallas. Hello, Romy.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I have two questions, actually. First one is it, how hard is it to pursue architecture as a career in your mid to 30s? I always been fascinated and in love with architecture, and I was convinced at an early age going into college to pursue something different by architects because it's such a cutthroat field, and I went the other way, and I should have really followed my heart and my passion. And now it's always, yeah, it's always been in the back of my mind, and I'm thinking about it right now, and I'm in my mid-30s. First question is how hard is it to pursue architecture as a career in your mid-30s?
Okay. Well, actually, it's difficult being an architect today, period. It's, you know, it's, we're all responding to kind of an unprecedented recession, and it affects architecture and architects greatly. Having said that, you know, architecture is a very difficult profession, but it's also a profession that if you're inspired by what you do and love the process, it's thrilling. And I tell students, I do teach, as I mentioned, I tell students, don't be an architect, but if you have to, it's the best thing in the world.
It's interesting because that's what they tell a lot of people in the arts themselves. Like, if you can think of anything else you'd like to do, do that. But if you have to do this.
So, Romy, in answer to your question, I'd say if you really have the passion for it, go for it. And there are a lot of different aspects of being an architect. And so maybe you need to find out more about what some of those aspects are and follow your dream. I think that's always a good thing.
He talked about making that career change in his 30s. And I want to sort of take this back to the Maybeck Award that you received this year for lifetime achievement. You were still very much within your career. Is it strange to think that you could be doing this for another 20 years and have a lifetime achievement award under your belt?
Well, okay, let me just put the Maybeck Award in perspective. It's given to an architect in California from the California American Institute of Architects. And it's not officially called a lifetime achievement. It's but the recipients tend to have had a longish career. But I mean, what makes me feel good is that yes, I can keep doing this for many, many, many years to come.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's speak next with Anita in Dallas. Hi, Anita.
Hi. Back to your sustainability concern, which I heartily share. Since we do have these glass-wrapped buildings in Dallas, I was wondering if there are ever any architectural awards that are given for finding the most brilliant retrofitting of those buildings to make them use the solar energy instead of being merely an utter nightmare to air condition.
Great question. Retrofitting, not sexy, but important.
Well, actually, retrofitting can be sexy, too. There have been some buildings that have been repurposed. And I happen to know that the GSA, which is the General Services Administration, which is the United States government, basically, has a very innovative building program. And they are doing some, they are repurposing some of their federal buildings that were built in the 50s and 60s and 70s that tend to look like these glass-wrapped towers. And they're, I know that they're doing that in Portland right now. A talented architect friend of mine, Jim Cutler, is the lead designer on that. Just adding to that a little bit, the federal government plan that builds federal courthouses is very interested in sustainability, both new and retrofit.
We have an email here from Paul in Farmers Branch who wants to know the value of LEEDs as a way of measuring and predicting overall energy efficiency of a building. Paul points out some consider it counterproductive when it comes to energy efficient design.
Right. LEED, L-E-E-D, is the measuring system that is more or less the accepted measuring system in the United States at this point in time. And I think it is effective. I think that one could build a sustainable building and not necessarily go by LEED guidelines, but I think that it is an important step forward. And I also believe that within 10 years, I would think all of that LEED knowledge might be embedded and expected of every building, and the point system will be less important, but I think it is very important right now.
Are the standards updated as time goes by and we do learn more?
Yes, that's true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's take another call and perhaps we can get the answer after the break, which we're about to come to. Let's speak this time with Maggie in Fort Worth. Hello, Maggie.
Well, I have just more of an observation about the effect of architecture. I have a friend from out of town whose husband is an architect. I was showing her around Fort Worth, and we came upon the Lena Pope home, and she did that classic stop the car. There's a Faye Jones building. And I asked her how she knew it was his work, and she just simply said, well, how do you know a symphony is by Beethoven? She really found it that beautiful as a piece. So I just wanted to throw that into the conversation.
Well, thank you very much. We'll get some more response in just a moment. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join the conversation with Stephen Ehrlich, is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We're talking to Stephen Ehrlich, of course, because he is in town to serve as lead juror for the 2011 AIA Dallas Design Awards. We'll be back in a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Our guest this hour is architect Stephen Ehrlich, who is in town to serve as lead juror for the 2011 AIA Dallas Design Awards. There will be a reception tomorrow at the Horchow Auditorium of the Dallas Museum of Art at 6:15, followed by a talk that Stephen will give at 7 o'clock. If you need more information, you can find it at aiadallas.org. If you want to be part of the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372. Or send email to think@kera.org. Going back, Stephen, to what we were discussing earlier about communicating with clients, how is that process different when you're working on a public work of architecture and you have to take input from everybody in a city or everybody in the place that you are serving?
Yes, sometimes it's complicated because you don't always know who the client is, mm-hmm. actually. There could be multiple stakeholders.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously you try to listen to everybody and try to resolve the issues. When we're designing a single family house, it's usually a husband and a wife. And so it's a smaller audience and hopefully they're on the same page.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Jim in Fort Worth. Hi, Jim.
Chris, how are you today?
Great. Thank you.
Stephen, let me take the discussion on sustainability in perhaps a bit more radical direction. I've had a keen interest for a number of years in straw bale construction,
mm-hmm.
and it has just always struck me as an outstanding opportunity not only to use nature's materials, but to build in such a way that cost per square foot can be reduced and total cost to own through energy efficiency can have a seriously positive impact. Why has what are your thoughts generally on that method of construction? Why has it not caught on, and where might you see that going in the future?
Okay. I've never used it myself, but so I'm not an expert and I can't really comment on that. But let me just mention one thing. When I was a younger practitioner and professor of architecture at Amadou Bello University, I was asked to design an experimental theater. And that theater was outside on the outskirts of the steel, glass, and concrete campus, and it was built out of mud and thatch roof. Hmm. And it was built out of all indigenous materials. It's a wonderful, loved building. It's still, to my amazement, still maintained. It's still in existence even after over 30 years. But the reality is that that's the kind of building that will have a very low fire rating. It will not be able to be used in a public arena for health and safety issues. It wouldn't necessarily stand up to earthquakes in California. So it just becomes complicated. But having said that, I don't know enough about straw bale to really comment, other than it seems like a material that would work perhaps very well in a rural and single-family residential situation.
We have an email here from Rhonda who says, you talk about collaboration. How do you integrate landscape architecture in your work and designs, especially considering sustainability?
The landscape is very important for us. We like to work closely with landscape architects. We have a group of different practitioners that we enjoy working with, depending on where the project is located. And we're very interested in that fusion of indoor and outdoor space. So I think it's very important to integrate that.
Another thing I know you've done with several of your designs is put a shade of some kind sort of outside the building itself. Talk about that. We in Texas, after the summer we've had,
right.
We'd love to hear more about that.
Okay, very good. Well, let me give you two examples. We are currently under construction with the John M. Roll U.S. Federal Courthouse in Yuma, Arizona. And that's named after John M. Roll, who was the unfortunately deceased
Gifford attacks.
In the Gifford attacks. That's right. The courthouse has been named after him. And the courthouse in Yuma is near downtown. And what we've done is we've created a very large shade structure in front of the building, which in a sense will become a huge front porch for everybody, for the entire community. And the shade is created by photovoltaic cells. Hmm. So not only are we creating or producing shade, we're also producing 25% of the building's electrical demand. So that's one example. Another example is we recently won the design competition to design the Parliament building for the Federal National Council of the United Arab Emirates. And we have a very large 100-meter dome, which is actually a shade structure hovering over the council chambers. And not only does it reduce the intensity of the heat, but it also casts beautiful Islamic patterns on white marble. So it's used in different ways, both artistically and in a very practical way as well.
How have photovoltaics changed over the past decade in ways that allow you to use them more creatively?
There are new products on the market. They are improving in terms of their efficiency, and there are some photovoltaics that are now embedded in glass, and that's quite interesting. And there are some that are – there's a newish technology called thin film, which can actually be applied to an existing flat roof.
Do they have to be kept very clean?
It's always better when they're clean. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are more efficient.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Enrico in Dallas. Hello, Enrico.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Listen, I am fascinated by the use of the novel use of shipping containers. And I wanted to know, in the architect's opinion, if we're going to see an exponential increase in the use of these structures, which are very structurally sound, and obviously some people have been doing wonderful things with these containers. I just wanted to know what is his take on this issue. Thank you.
Have you followed that trend at all?
Yeah. Well, I've seen some very creative uses of shipping containers. In fact, we have one in our parking lot for storage in Culver City. But in terms of using it as a building block, the Japanese architect Shigeru Ban did a very beautiful temporary museum built out of shipping containers that was actually used in New York and then reassembled in L.A., and this goes back a few years ago. I've seen one or two houses built out of them. I do not see an exponential increase in the use of them. They're generally, and certainly in terms of residential structure, they're large. You still need to deal with all the issues of how do you keep the water out of whatever you have assembled? How do you get electricity in? But I do see them as a building block that some very creative people have used.
How important is ongoing travel to your work?
It's very important. It's actually one of the reasons why I like to accept offers to be on an AIA jury right now here in Dallas. It's always a way of meeting new people and learning something new, and that's exciting. I will be, in 2 weeks' time, I'll be in Argentina exhibiting and talking at the Buenos Aires Biennale, which will be fun. As a teacher with my students, I often tell them, open your eyes and plagiarize. And what I mean by that is that there's so much to learn, and to be an architect, just always be absorbing information, be observant, see how people gather, see how the sun works, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's an ongoing, never-ending adventure.
When I was doing research about you and your work, I found online a design for this beautiful library that I think is also somewhere in the Southwest. Forgive me, because now I can't remember the city. It looked like the hull of a ship.
Oh, okay. That's actually in Southern California.
Okay.
And it's the Robertson Branch Library. Yes.
Well, it's extraordinary. And what I also saw was what looked like almost like a sketch on the back of a cocktail napkin. Do you start sometimes with something as simple as that?
Yes. Often the sketchbook is a great friend, and the hand and the mind and the eye somehow work together in mysterious ways, and it's still something that I like to do, and it's something that I encourage my students to do as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Megan in Dallas. Hi, Megan.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I work for a small company that does a great deal of training for architects and engineers, particularly in the LEED credit rating system. But we also train a lot of contractors in residential efficiency and renewables, and we get a lot of questions from contractors we work with, most of whom are, you know, unemployed or significantly underemployed, as well as a lot of small business owners looking to turn their business towards sustainable building. And they're wondering what sort of training would be best for them in order to prepare for new code changes and other movements towards sustainable building. Is LEED certification the right thing for them, or are there other trainings that they should take a look at?
I'm probably not the best person to answer this question, but I would think LEED training would be positive. Perhaps look into what the community college system might offer, too. It's not like you always need to have a degree in architecture, which is a 5 to 8 year journey. So I think there's probably opportunities out there, and I'm not sure specifically what they are, but I'm sure you could find out through community colleges and websites.
I'd love to talk to you about a project that I know had some personal significance to you. You restored a Rudolf Schindler house for your daughter and her family. Is that right?
That's right.
Talk about, first of all, when you found it, when you found the building, were you very excited that it was available, or are there sort of a number of these around that need work?
Right. Let me actually just tell some of your listeners who Rudolf Schindler is. Rudolf Schindler was one of the great architects in Los Angeles. He's been deceased for several decades, immigrated from Europe back in the late, probably 1918, and built a very famous house called the Schindler House on Kings Road in Los Angeles, and is, in a sense, considered the father of California modernism. By accident, we were over at some friend's house in Inglewood, California, and found out that a derelict but intact mini Schindler house was available in right next door. And it was a probate sale, and I got excited about it. I co-adventured with my daughter and son-in-law, and we all agreed this would be a great project. We fixed it up, and they have since bought the house from me, and it's been a terrific project. And it's also a form of recycling to take an old house, and not everybody would have saved that house. A lot of people would have just knocked it down because of the condition it was in. So it makes us feel good in multiple ways.
Did you have the sense that you were really inside his head when you were working so closely with his design?
You know, in a way, yes. And I learned again about the genius of Schindler. This is a very modest house. It's only a 1,000-foot house. Mm-hmm. Small is good. It's a new trend. And the thing that we did, though, is we didn't try to freeze it completely in time. I mean, there were only two inhabitants over 70 years. The kitchen and bathroom were just really a mess and completely outdated. So we answered every question by saying, well, what would Schindler do today if he was alive? And that's how we answered it. And we said, well, he wouldn't be a stick in the mud. No, he'd be willing to change. But we tried to answer every question with that in mind.
When you're designing new construction, do you even attempt to think about what people might need in 30 years, or is that really a sort of a losing proposition?
What they need is the ability to change. It's interesting. Huh. They need flexibility. And I'm thinking right now in particular in the academic environment. We do quite a bit of university work and colleges. And what you think you know today, you will need to modify within 5 years. So if you can create the format for that change, the platform for the changing of technology systems, and yet the shell of the building and all of the components that hold it up, keep the environment out, need to be, of course, permanent.
So good design principles haven't necessarily changed, but the way we incorporate our stuff into them has?
That's a way to put it.
Very
well spoken.
Talk about this. When you think about the interior space of a building you're designing, how much thought do you put into what sort of furnishings will be there that you may have nothing to do with but still have to consider?
Right. Well, first of all, we do specify the furnishings for our public buildings. Mm-hmm. And in our residential projects, we will either work with the owners hand in hand as they select their furniture, or sometimes an interior designer is also used. So it varies.
Mm-hmm. And the last thing I want to ask you is, tomorrow, is it just an incredibly long day for you? How does that all play out?
Tomorrow will be a long day. It's when we get to judge there will be three of us, mm-hmm. and we get to judge all about 70 submittals from the community, the architectural community. We will pick the winners. And after the winners are announced, I'll be giving a slide lecture entitled Multicultural Modernism. And I think people will enjoy it if they come.
That takes place tomorrow at the Horchow Auditorium at the DMA. Stephen Ehrlich is design principal of the firm Stephen Ehrlich Architects. Thank you so much for being with us this hour.
It's been great to be here. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.